What could you do if your data was working for you and not against you? With Bloomberg delivering enterprise data directly to your systems, you get easy access to the details you want, optimized for higher level analysis, and financial data experts committed to helping you maximize your every move. Our data is made for more, so you can show the world what you're made of. Visit Bloomberg.com/enterprise data to learn more.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Law Podcast. I'm June Grosso. Every day we bring you insight and analysis into the most important legal news of the day. You can find more episodes of the Bloomberg Law Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, and on Bloomberg.com/podcasts.
The Washington Post and New York Times have reported that President Trump wanted to fire Robert Mueller in June 2017, something that Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal called stunning.
This report shows there's now a credible case of obstruction of justice.
But even if Mueller has an obstruction case, Bloomberg News is now reporting that he may put any charges on hold as he finishes other key parts of his probe into Russian election meddling. Kevin Whitelaw, Bloomberg News deputy managing editor, stops in for more on this story in our Bloomberg 99.1 studios in Washington. And Kevin, this was a nice scoop by our team. What does it say?
Well, that's exactly right. We do know that Mueller's in the final stages of the obstruction part of his probe. He's got a couple of key outstanding interviews that he might want to pursue. We understand he's in negotiations with President Trump's lawyers about an interview with the president. There's another witness to a number of key events that Mueller's studying, who has yet to be interviewed, as far as we know, and that's Donald Trump Jr. Those are two high-profile interviews, but sort of the sequencing of how you sort of hold those interviews and close out a portion of this probe is a very complicated decision for him, given that there's other aspects of the probe that are going to take weeks or months to complete. And so there's a growing sense and growing belief that there's a chance Mueller could, even if he decides to essentially conduct the interviews and effectively wrap up the probe, he may essentially keep his findings, withhold his findings for a while he then turns his attention to other elements of the probe and goes from there.
Bloomberg News is reporting that also factoring into this is that witnesses may become less cooperative in other parts of the probe, and the president might make a move if that comes out about obstruction to shut it down.
Well, that's right. You have the problem where you, if to the degree that Mueller makes charges, then that potentially provokes one set of conflicts. If he effectively clears anybody on this side of it, then that's suddenly going to say, "Hey, it's time to wrap up. Let's go." And we know for various reasons he's got weeks and months of work on a number of different areas in the probe. So he's got all of that hanging over his head, along with obviously the sort of more existential threat of the president deciding to try to find a way to simply fire him if he gets too close. So there are a number of those calculations that factor in. We do know there are several key episodes that that Mueller and his team are focusing on for trying to figure out whether there was indeed any effort to obstruct justice, and those include a couple of key meetings. One was discussed the decision to fire FBI Director James Comey. The other was a discussion aboard Air Force One over the response to reports about a meeting organized at Trump Tower that included Trump Jr. and Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law.
So walk us through the timing on all of this, keeping in mind that there's something happening this November. What is it?
Some kind of election.
Midterms. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we don't really have a lot of information on the timing. Mueller doesn't have a deadline per se, other than maybe a political one. So he's made it clear through his methodical approach so far that he's going to take the investigation wherever he thinks it needs to go. But at the same time, I don't think he's looking for ways to stretch it out. So he's clearly feeling pressure to keep moving. We've seen a succession of indictments and plea deals, including an indictment of 13 Russians for social media activity during the election. We are expecting at some point there to be another indictment of a set of Russians for hacking, We haven't seen that yet. We have reason to believe that that's in the works. And so that's one of the next things we're looking for that could effectively come at any time. And there's still other aspects of the probe that we've had a lot less visibility into, including questions of how deep, if at all, Mueller really is going into the finances of either the president, Trump org, or Jared Kushner's company. So there's a lot of questions we still don't know, even as we have some new insight into some of the decision making and processes that are going on right now.
So Mueller has to prove corrupt intent on Trump's part for the obstruction part of the case, if he intends to go after him for obstruction. And could he be putting the obstruction case on hold because he wants to talk to Trump? And his attorney and Trump's attorneys have been fighting that tooth and nail.
Well, you know, it's interesting. As we understand it, Trump's legal team has actually been in negotiations since late last year. Negotiations that we're told have actually gone on relatively smoothly and constructively,
but with no end in sight. There's still no interview. Yeah,
but what's unclear though is which side the delay is on. There does seem to have been a flurry of activity with Mueller that has, in other words, just his investigation continuing. So, you know, you saw Steve Bannon meet with Mueller a few weeks ago. You know, the president's going to be essentially the last or one of the last interviews that Mueller would want to have when it comes to an obstruction case. So he wants to interview absolutely everybody. And it feels like there's a couple more alleyways and side doors that Mueller wanted to go down before he gets that interview. There is a very good question, though, as to when that interview would actually happen. And if there is a delay, a lot of he said, she said over which side might be responsible for it.
Also want to remember that there are these investigations going on the Hill. The House Intelligence Committee investigation has obviously kind of, you know, broken down to into a partisan mess. But where does the Senate Intelligence Committee investigation stand?
Well, that's still basically there's two investigations in the Senate. That's the truly sort of the most serious of them, the most bipartisan of them that's ongoing. The Judiciary Panel is continuing to look at certain aspects with elements and glimpses of bipartisan work. But the Senate Intelligence Panel is where you are seeing a much fuller effort to try to be bipartisan. Having said that, there are disputes over what public hearings might still be held before this thing is wrapped up. And that seems to be one of the biggest outstanding questions that they have as to whether or not that will have a bipartisan conclusion to it. But in the meantime, they are aiming to release an interim report on election security ahead of the midterms. That's something that we could tell that obviously Mueller was interested in, given the indictment of the social media, the Russians doing the social media attacks. The Senate Intelligence Committee also has a lot of interest in this topic. So that's a report we could see in the coming days or weeks.
Kevin, it seems as if Mueller is going into different areas. Is that because we're just learning about those areas, or he is actually expanding the investigation?
That's a very, very good question. And I think it's probably a little bit of both. This is an investigation that's very complex. And because the Mueller team is basically as tight as basically any of these as any probe like this has ever been, leaks are very selective and tend to come in some cases from the witnesses, and some of those might be self-serving or carrying out a grudge or whatever, and others are legitimately real information. So sorting through what's real, what's not is a challenge. Sorting through what's new and what's not is a challenge. But there do seem to be some areas that have come to light in recent weeks or months that do seem to be genuinely new to the probe. And I think everyone's still trying to figure out exactly what this means and how seriously Mueller's taking these things. I mean, remember, I'd caution, just because he asked a witness about a particular topic doesn't mean he's fully investigating that topic. These are hours and hours of interviews he's doing with each witness or his team is doing.
He looks like a serious guy.
Well, that's right. But he's going to be asking a lot of questions. And some of the things are the ones he's going to be targeting, and others are just going to be testing the waters. And it's very hard to sort through all of that from the outside.
Sure. Kevin Whitelaw, Bloomberg News Deputy Managing Editor. Thank you.
Foreign nations and U.S. customers harmed by President Trump's steel and aluminum tariffs face a slow legal fight challenging the tariffs, and the role of U.S. courts in the global dispute is likely to be limited. Joining me is Matt Gold, adjunct professor of law at Fordham University and former deputy assistant U.S. trade representative. Matt, countries can complain to the World Trade Organization, but that is less like litigation and more like a dispute settlement process. Explain the process if a foreign country claims against makes a claim against the U.S. there.
Sure, I'd be glad to. The process has three basic stages. The first stage is what's known as consultations. It's like an opportunity to settle the case before you're into litigation itself. The parties are required to engage in consultations, but if consultations are going nowhere, within a relatively short period of time, the countries that brought the case can call them to an end and move on to the next stage. The next stage is a panel, a three-member panel, which is essentially litigating before a three-judge court. The panelists are experts. They're from countries that are not, that don't have an interest in the dispute. And that litigation can take 1 to 2 years, or a little bit more or less, depending on the complexity of the case. And the third stage is appealing the panel decision to the WTO appellate body, which for a major case like this is almost a certainty.
So in the end, the WTO can tell a country to stop violating the rules, but does it have any real power, or is it world perception at work?
Oh, no, it has quite real power. It's the one international court that has real power to enforce international law, the law that imparts rights and obligations to governments. The power it has is to authorize retaliation, to authorize a country. If other countries demonstrate, for example, the United States has violated WTO rules at the end of the process, the WTO appellate body will first, the appellate body rules that the U.S. has violated the WTO agreements and explains why and how. It gives the United States a chance to bring itself into compliance. But then the fourth and last stage, if the United States fails to change what it's doing, is to authorize retaliation. Then there's really a fourth procedure by which the countries that took us to court propose to the appellate body what kind of retaliation they want to engage in. It'll be some kind of trade barriers against U.S. goods or services going to their countries. And then the WTO appellate body will authorize specific such trade barriers, specific retaliation.
The EU has already threatened to retaliate against the U.S. Might it do that before going to the WTO?
Well, there's always a risk of that. That would really send us into a downward spiral. The whole point of the WTO dispute resolution process is to give countries a legal mechanism for retaliation so that we don't run into you violated the treaty and in response we're going to violate the treaty and everything goes into a downward spiral that collapses a global trading system. Instead, the process, first of all, gives the countries an opportunity to settle disputes. Second of all, it's a process where it takes a little bit of time so everyone can sort of have cool heads. It gives the country that's violating the rules a chance to get its own political act in order because usually there's some kind of domestic political forces pushing the violation, and they have some time to fix that. But at the end of the day, if the retaliation is authorized by the WTO, then the retaliation is not another violation. And that also sort of helps everything from going into an uncontrolled downward spiral.
So the Trump administration has already exempted Mexico and Canada from the tariffs. They may make more exceptions. How does that affect the U.S. argument before the WTO that the tariffs are based on national security needs?
The U.S. never had a winning argument before the WTO. There's two different sets of law here. There's the U.S. law and there's the international law. On the international level, in order for the United States to impose trade barriers that we would otherwise not be entitled to impose under our trade agreement obligations, if we're using national security as our reason, we'd have to either be in time of war or we'd have to be in an emergency in international relations, which is generally understood to be the things that happen right before you're actually in a war. But in any event, we don't have either. We have nothing that could even be close to an emergency international relations. What we have are U.S. government officials that can envisage an unlikely but theoretically possible future scenario where there would be a World War III global ocean shipping would be disrupted. We would not be able to import steel or aluminum in meaningful quantities because they need to go by ocean freight, not air freight. And we wouldn't have sufficient capacity for our own domestic economy during that disruption. The fact that you can envisage a theoretical but unlikely future does not even come close to you currently right now having an emergency. So there's no question that we don't qualify for that national security exception that's in the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, the GATT Article 21. And as a result, we are violating our normal bindings with respect to the duties that the ordinary customs duties that we're allowed to impose on these goods. So we never had an argument. Our complete absence of argument to defend ourselves in the WTO is a more complete absence of argument. But the big difference, though, that it does make is under U.S. law. Even if the U.S. were authorized under WTO rules to impose these barriers, there still would be the question of whether the Congress
we'll have
or
to
the
leave
president.
It at that. We'll pick this up again, I'm sure, Matt. Thanks so much. That's Matt Gold of Fordham Law School. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Law Podcast. You can subscribe and listen to the show on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, and on Bloomberg.com/podcast. I'm June Grosso. This is Bloomberg.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.